So, hi, I am your host, Paul Growney, and welcome to episode one of the Who Cares podcast, as brought to you by local charity Caring Connections. So this podcast is dedicated to bringing you them people who care across the Liverpool City region. So all we hear is doom and gloom, Brexit, bad news stories, hoodies, ket wigs, reality TV, plebs. This is about bringing you the real people from the Liverpool City region who are all there trying to make a difference. And one of the key things we want to do with this podcast is really raise awareness of what's out there. So if you, a family friend, or anyone's in need of support, you know, you can know where to access it. And also, it's bringing you them inspiring people that have found a gap in the market, have found a gap in need in our community, and have chose to put something back in, have chose to make that difference. So it's about that. We're going to be having some guests on, having a bit of a laugh, but also getting into some deep subjects as well. This week we have Debbie Rogers from Sean's Place. Hello, Debbie.
Hi.
A support charity set up to support men to improve their mental health and well-being. But I'm not going to go too much into that yet, because Debbie's going to tell us a bit more about that later on. But we're going to be hearing a lot from Debbie in terms of, you know, her background, why she does it, what she has to offer, and really a bit about what inspires her to care. So based on that, this month we're going to be focusing on the topic of mental health and suicide. A very tough subject, but very topical at the same time. But it's vital that as a community, as organisations, and as the Liverpool City region, we look at ways we can identify areas of prevention that we can use to help reduce the number of suicides and help make the Liverpool City region the most suicide aware region in the whole of the UK. We know Liverpool's the best, and I think can be the best in this as well. So just to get started, our first segment, we're going to look at a bit of just a few stats. So we're going to get nerdy with it just to start with. So just to begin with, I've got a little some facts and statistics from the mental health charity Mind. For those who aren't familiar, Mind is a national mental health charity that has a range of support services available. Does Mind, I don't think there's a Mind in Liverpool. Is there a Mind in Liverpool, Debbie?
I think Cheshire's the near one. Or the Whittle, there's a Whittle.
Yeah, so you got Cheshire and Whittle. So there's not one in Liverpool. So if you're listening, you feel inspired, set one up in Liverpool. So looking at the statistics, yeah, just some mental health facts and statistics. So we've got approximately one in four people in the UK will experience a mental health problem each year. And one in six people report experience in a common mental health problem in any given week. So, you know, they're quite heavy statistics. I mean, you know, what does statistics mean when you're going through it yourself? I don't know. I mean, and again, I'm not really sure with these statistics. Are these people who are reporting it, or who are actually, you know, they're just estimating it? Because a lot of things like this, it says most people don't even report they're having mental health problems. So, you know, how do we know how right these are? I mean, again, I'm just bringing these up just to show that it's a massive issue. And I know everyone listening is. We're inundated with campaigns around time to talk. You know, we need to talk to someone and all this type of game. But one of the things we're trying to talk about, especially with this podcast and people like Debbie, who's on today, is about the services to actually improve mental health. Not just about putting your hand up and saying, I've got an issue. Well, where are these services that are there to actually help solve the issue? And people like Debbie and other organisations in the city are fighting that good fight, and we need to learn more about them. So that's what a bit about today is about. So as I said, suicide is the topic of today that we were looking at. So to go a bit about on that, we're looking at the Samaritans website. And you know, the Samaritans is a fantastic organisation, and I think, one, if you're in crisis, you should always look around, giving them a call. I mean, I started this game as a Samaritans volunteer, and I tell you this, prior to doing any of that, I wasn't into volunteer and charity. You know, who cares? I've got to admit, I didn't give a monkeys about any of this game until I actually, I think I saw an advert at Christmas of, you know, someone alone and someone talking about suicide, which actually got me aware of the Samaritans and what they did. I don't know if you, did you ever see that, like, they put it on around Christmas around the Samaritans and the work they did, and the they were advertising the phone numbers.
I don't remember seeing it. All I know is that the Samaritans, because it's so big, you don't it doesn't tend to be the go-to place, but actually they're amazing, so why aren't people using it more?
And that's it. I mean, I went there to the place on Clarence Street in town, and I said, you know, I wanted to volunteer, and I didn't have a scooby about really what went on and how you did it. And it was probably, and I mean, I've done uni courses and all that, and I'd say it's probably one of the best courses I've ever done in my life. It was 12 weeks. You went one night a week, and you did role plays and everything. And it was just really intense, but you met a fantastic group of people. But what I learned from that is when people were phoning you up, it just changed your way of looking at the world, you know, dealing with these people, listening to some of the issues. And one of the things with the Samaritans is that even though it's people who are suicidal, you can't tell them not to do it. It's a listening service, so you're asking them strategic questions, really, to, you know, hopefully a person would talk themselves out of it. But an excellent service. But again, just one of many. But again, if you're in Liverpool and you're in crisis, it is on Clarence Street in Liverpool, down by the, I think, is it the Redmond building? The, you know, the John Moore's one?
Yeah, around the corner.
Yeah, it's down there. So, and I think they even have a drop-in service. It's a 24/7 phone service. But it's actual, you can actually drop in and speak to someone as well. So if you're in crisis, I would highly recommend that. It's a very good service. Anyway, so we're talking about some facts and figures. So if we go on to the suicide figures on the Samaritans website, and I don't want to bore people to death with some of these figures, but it's just important to know, because I think last year, I don't know if it was it St. Helens had the highest suicide rates in the UK?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I just mention as well, while with the Samaritans, the contact number?
That's a good shout.
Well prepared. 116 123.
116 123. Okay, so the Samaritans number is 116 123. So if you're in need or in crisis, please contact that number. As I say, we'll be putting it up. If you visit our website, we'll have details on that. Did you have an email and text service as well?
They do have a text service as well. I'll find out more information about that. Maybe we can add it on later on.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, it's a fantastic service and I would highly recommend it. So as I say, we're going on to the statistics, and as we were just talking about, I think St. Helens, which was part of the Liverpool City region, had one of the highest suicide rates in the UK, and I think it did in from 2017 to 2018. I mean, what makes it, why St. Helens? I don't know. I mean, what may, I know this year it reduced. I think it went down by to the 11th or something like that. Because I remember what happened was, I was in Tenerife in a water park, in Aqualand in Tenerife. But I'd say, like, do not go there. It's proper the iffiest water park in
sounds
the world.
Sounds dead posh.
There's nothing posh about it. Like, you come out and your feet are just destroyed from being in the wave pool. It's like, oh, it's grim. But anyway, I was in the tenant, and my phone goes, and it's the woman off BBC Merseyside saying, oh, do you want to do an interview on why suicide rates have reduced in St. Helens? And a bit about, so we were talking a bit about from Care and Connections points, from the postvention support and bereavement by suicide. But I remember she went, I'll phone you back in a bit. So I was in there, I had to go to the other side of the water park on under the umbrella doing this thing. The ones having these, oh, so suicide and all that. All of a sudden, the tannoy's going off saying it's the next dolphin show. And this was a live interview on the radio I was doing. But again, you know, it was an interesting thing. But the suicide figures, because they're quite small figures, can be very distorted by a small change in numbers. And I think that's what happened in St. Helens' case. So if we just look at the statistics report from the Samaritans, I think actually suicides, even though there's a lot more being done, I think the figures actually went up for last year. I don't know, does that ring a bell with you? Oh, here we go. Key facts from 2018. In the UK and the Republic of Ireland, there was 6,859 suicides in the UK. Death by suicide rose by 10.9%. Men, as we all know, men are much more likely to take their own lives than women. But again, you know, if one person takes their own life regardless, you know, that is a massive destruction of families. So men are three times as likely to die by suicide than women. But one of the interesting things what I found is that even though a lot of time you hear it's, you know, the biggest killer of young men, and it's very much campaigns tied to young men, it's saying the highest suicide rate is among men aged 45 to 49. And I'm not too sure whether I've seen that many interventions or awareness campaigns aimed at that specific group. Again, in Republic of Ireland, 55 to 65. I don't know if that's a thing. I mean, I see a lot from organisations like CALM and all this around young men. You're constantly bombarded with things around that, but I can't say I've ever seen anything specifically for that age group with men.
I think a lot of organisations target young men to try and tackle the problem while they're young, before it becomes a bigger issue when, unfortunately, they get to that age. And when you look at that age group as well, are they more likely to go and seek help at that age? Do they have the support of parents supporting them to go to places to get support? A lot of ex-forces are around that age as well, so you've got PTSD. Yeah. There's a million and one reasons I can think of why that age group would need more support. Which is why with Sean's Place, when I was looking at opening it, I was asked to put an age limit on it. I was told, you have to find your niche, I said, absolutely not, I'm not doing it. Because why was I turning someone away? Because they're 55, or because, you know, ours is 21 upwards, but that's because the adults, when they turn 21. But I wasn't put an age cap on it because they're 60 or because they're 45, because every single male needs support. It doesn't matter how old they are.
Do you think potentially, controversially, that because there's been so many of these sort of interventions and campaigns on the younger age group, it's kind of left this gap and this maybe excluded sort of demographic of people that is now coming to the forefront?
Yeah, possibly it could be. I think there's a lot of focus, especially like with football, and I think football's doing amazing things for mental health at the moment. There's a lot of campaigns around just before games and things.
Yeah.
And a lot of young people will be watching that, which is great. You know, we want these young men to be getting support as early as possible, but unfortunately they're not targeted towards men at that age. And, you know, it's a wake-up call for a lot of us. We need to be finding interventions and sessions and support that is attractive to people at that age, so they will reach out. There's a lot to learn still.
Yeah, yeah. And that's it. It is about learning, and it's about evaluating properly the interventions that are out there. I mean, I'm not going to go into any more statistic stuff because, to be honest, a lot of it is boring, depressing, and even though we're talking about a subject matter which is not the lightest, we're trying to look at it from a point of view of how do we improve this situation, because anyone can dig into statistics. And what we know from suicide is that often the statistics are a lot lower than what they actually are. There's a lot of things that aren't actually reported suicides. There's suicide attempts. There's all sorts. And a lot of it as well is how many people are actually impacted by suicide within the community. I mean, getting a bit nerdy with it, we were going through some, research in terms of what things are out there to prevent suicide, what different things are there to try and prevent them. And it's a study by the RAND Association, which we'll put on the website, and he kind of summarised a lot of what's out there. And he said effective was things like training on coping skills and self-referral. I mean, I find that interesting, like coping skills, but I mean, I always find like you're trained to cope when you're not in the situation you need to cope for. It's like, I do breathing exercises before I get a tattoo, but then when the tattoo needle hits me, I'm effing and blinded and crying and effing. So I don't know what to think about that. I mean, it's showing in this study by Egger that 1995 that it did improve outcomes, but again, I'm not sure if that's getting to the source, because it breaks it down in coping skills, acute intervention, and also training other people to be more aware of suicide and how to intervene with, you know, people who are suicidal. I mean, I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that, Debbie. I know we're going to get into Sean's place in a little while, but just in terms of your views on prevention, if you were to, if you had the dough in your pocket and you said, right, I'm going to invest in this, what would you look to invest in?
I think at the moment, you know, this is so new for me anyway. I've only been trying to do this for 6 months since we lost Sean. So where Sean's place is about the early intervention, it's it is the acute.
Yeah.
People who are coming in and they're suffering from signs of stress and anxiety, what there isn't enough of, and it's more reactive than preventative, I find, is get people who are at a crisis point. It's the support for the people who are in crisis. There's an amazing place that so many people have recommended called James's Place in Liverpool. We're very lucky to have it. But other than that, we've got, A&E.
Yeah.
A four-hour wait in A&E to see the crisis team there, by which time some people, it's just too much for them to bear and they walk out, and sadly we're left with more suicides. And I think people are scared to touch crisis point because it's a scary subject. I'm not trained at all to manage people who are in that situation, sadly. I'd love to be able to say, yeah, we'll open it up to everybody. But there does need to be more training and more support and quicker support for people who are at that awful time, and more support for families as well. The messages I get at the moment with parents and wives and, you know, everybody, they're just so worried about the family members. And they're like, where can I go?
Yeah.
And sadly, I don't know where to signpost them to other than A&E. And I know what's going to happen when they get to A&E.
Yeah.
Not all the time, don't get me wrong. Doctors and nurses do a fabulous job, but they're so overwhelmed. It's impossible for them to help everybody as quick as they need it.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think one of the things what has come, I think maybe it's a negative of, you know, increasing people, you know, awareness to talk about the issues and tell people if they're feeling suicidal. It then leaves the family with this sort of situation of how did he manage that? How did he best support that person? And if they're having to wait 6 months or whatever for an appointment with a psychiatrist or a counselling visit, and, you know, how does the family manage that? And then all of a sudden you've got the family member who's got anxiety and depression. Yeah, and it's a, I mean, I know from, you know, a personal experience of actually going through the hospital system or going to A&E with someone who was suicidal, and you've got people in the beds next year who've got broken legs or, you know, appendicitis or whatever, you know, all of them with pain, and then you've got a young person or whatever age sitting in a chair telling a doctor and a nurse who had run off the feet of, you know, stressed out the mind, telling them, well, you know, I want to do myself in. And you're like, oh, well, go and sit back out in the waiting room, we'll have someone see you. 5 hours later, you've got a, you know, a suicide liaison, you know, nurse who's then providing you with, you know, some medication and an appointment to see your GP tomorrow. And then all of a sudden, you've waited all night there, you're out, and this has happened. But luckily, in this case, that person's got family with them to look after them. I think if you've been brave enough to go to A&E on your own, and then you're sent out, you know, what happens then? You know what I mean?
Sadly, meeting the criteria for hospital as well. The night before Sean passed away, I'd called and asked for help, and Sean didn't tick the boxes. He didn't meet the criteria for hospital. And a lot of people will be finding that. He did meet the criteria, 100% he did, but the call handler who was listening to him that night, I don't know what training people have had who are answering these calls, but I think more investment needs in that to be in that side of things as well. You know, you can't make a judgment off somebody's tone of voice. There needs to be more facilities available where they can go and have a face-to-face discussion and be assessed face-to-face, whether that be somewhere other than A&E. But I'm hoping that down the line, that's something that we'll see. There's more crisis centres that aren't based in A&E departments, so that they're more accessible and more reactive.
Do you ever think we'll get to a point in society where mental health is seen, or is on, what is it, priority, what's the word?
Priority.
No, what is it? The thing where it's equal, mental health equal to physical health, it's got, I don't know, it begins with a P.
On par.
On par, yeah. On par. On par with physical health in terms of the treatment resources allocated.
It needs to be, like you've mentioned a stat before, saying one in four people have a mental health condition. Mm. Yeah, they do, but one in one, and this has come from a fancy Facebook post, don't get me wrong, but one in one people have mental health. Everybody has mental health. It's something to tell my children now, since losing Sean. We all have mental health the way we all have physical health.
Yeah.
And it's how we look after that. And it's got to become normal. It can't be scary to talk about it anymore. It's got to be normal talking about your brain and your mind as much as it is talking about your sore leg or your sore back.
Do you think it's something that should be instilled from school?
Yeah, and I think schools are getting there. I work in a school as well, and schools are so overwhelmed. They're terrified to touch on subjects like that because they're not prepared enough. There isn't resources to bring into schools to discuss it. But luckily, there is new organisations. There's one who I'm going to meet tomorrow called Malice in the Community.
Okay.
And they do drama-based workshops.
Okay.
So it's talking about mental health.
Sorry, Debbie, what was that called?
Malice in the Community.
Malice in the Community, okay.
Yeah, they're a new organisation, but they deliver training of mental health through drama. So it's more accessible and it gets people interested because it's not in black and white, it's not a lesson, it's not a lecture, it's fun. And I think if we can develop more programs like that, schools will reach out a little bit more and bring them in.
Yeah.
And then children are able to learn about mental health but in a child friendly way.
Yeah, yeah. Rather than hitting them dead hard with a real.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I suppose, okay, then going. We've kind of mixed it around a podcast, but it's the first one. But okay, then. So just to introduce yourself, Debbie, just tell us a bit about Sean's place and, you know, where to come from.
So Sean was my brother. We lost Sean to mental health in July 2019, last year. So it's only 6 months ago. But Sean was, you know, he was amazing. But he was having counselling for his mental health and he was on medication. But what he didn't have was anything to pick his mood back up. So he'd go to counselling, he'd talk about this really bad experience that he'd had and, you know, it being a really dark place after it, but then allowed to go home and live on his own.
Yeah.
Whereas I used to say, come on, there must be something else he can do afterwards or, you know, do instead where he can meet different people who feel the same and he can take part in things that will make him feel good about himself. But there wasn't any, well, I'm not saying there wasn't any, his nurse and his doctors wasn't aware of anywhere that he could go. And sadly, when we lost Sean, there was actually a couple of places he could have went. We just weren't aware of them. So when we lost Sean, obviously we wanted to keep his memory alive as much as possible and honour him in like a way that would help others as well, which is what he would have wanted. So I came up with the idea of creating Sean's Place, which is a mental health and wellbeing centre.
Yeah.
Specifically for men over the age of 21, where we can offer sessions that will improve the mood but also support mental health and wellbeing without it being clinical.
Yeah.
So we don't have counselling at Sean's Place at the moment. As much as counselling is needed, it's not something we can offer at the moment. But what we do have is things that will improve confidence, self-esteem, it'll reduce social isolation. You know, men can come and mix with each other of all different ages, from all different backgrounds, but have this common ground that they're all there for the same reason, to look after themselves and improve the quality of life, really.
And where's it based, Debbie?
So we've got two venues. One is at Connect Studios in Seaforth.
Okay.
And the other one is Community by Nature in Bootle.
Okay.
We're officially due to open the end of January, 30th of January.
Brilliant.
We've done a couple of pilot days just to make sure we get it right and make sure that the sessions are things that men actually want. You know, I'm a female, so I can't sit and say, you know, what men want. You know, my husband will tell you that anyway. But I've given a go and the feedback's been brilliant and the sessions work, which is great. So
how would a fella come to it? How would they say come to a session or book on or find out about what's on offer?
Well, it's just a drop in. You know, people don't have to take part in sessions. That's an important thing to get across. They can just come in and have a cup of coffee and sit with each other and have a natter. But the sessions are there so that they can also do something productive with the day once they've got the confidence up and they get to know us a bit better. They will take a dive and go into a mindfulness class I think there's this stigma around men lying on the floor, breathing in sync with each other. It's not any manly,
yeah,
is it?
Yeah, yeah.
But actually, when they take part in it, they love it because it reduces their anxiety, it reduces stress levels. It's techniques you can do at home as well.
So what type of feedback, like even, I know we're at the pilot stage, but what sort of feedback have you got so far from the fellas that have come?
Yeah, it's been great. It's been really positive and something that's been missing in the community. We have got things in Sefton that are amazing, don't get me wrong. But the feedback that we've had is that they wish they'd have found us sooner. And it's like, when are you open? When are you open? So look, now we can say that we're open, but we've had to get our foundations right first.
Yeah. So how would you find out about like what times the things are on and things like that and say, right, I want to come to a mindfulness session. How would I go about doing that? Do we just turn up or do I have to book on or how's it work?
So at the moment we're all over social media. We're doing really well on social media.
Is it just Sean's Place?
Yeah, Sean's Place 2. Sean's Place was taken.
Okay.
So with Sean's Place 2 on Facebook and Twitter and Sean's Place UK on Instagram.
Okay.
And so all the information's on there. Our website goes live this month as well, which Brilliant. Is amazing. We're very, very lucky to have a good support
and
with
that. And what's that going to be, Sean's Place?
.org.uk.
Okay.
Yeah, and our timetable will be on there.
Yeah, S-E-A-N, innit?
Yeah, S-E-A-N.
Yeah. My brother's called Sean as well.
Yeah, good name.
Yeah.
So we will have the timetable available on there. And people don't have... The only thing that people will have to book onto will be our solution-focused hypnotherapist. And
okay.
That's just to make sure that people are suitable to go in and have that treatment. And it doesn't clash with any other treatment that they're having. But anything else is not clinical.
Yeah.
So they're able to just come and go with
them. It's like a safe space.
It is.
Yeah.
And it's options. We're quite lucky because at Connect Studios, we've got sessions like art and mindfulness, and it's quite relaxed. But then in our other venue, we've just partnered up with Community by Nature, who have got funding to do a men's forest school.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah,
looks boss,
it looks amazing. So they're doing like bushcrafts and natural arts and learning to make a campfire and stuff.
So, like, be Ponsonard in the woods and that, like, Aunt Middleton.
Yeah, yeah. Honestly,
well,
God, it's like big Bootle Bear Grills, we're calling it.
Bootle Bear Grills. Oh, he sounds scary.
But they get a first aid certificate and a food hygiene certificate as well. So, again, it's something they can put on the CV if they're looking for work. It's all about boosting that confidence. But they've got a beautiful outdoor area, so we're able to do like gardening and things like that.
Fantastic.
As well. So,
but this, from what I understand with Sean's Place, it's open. It's going to be open at times where even if you do work and you're struggling in work, you can still access support. It's not just going to be like an all day thing if people who are unemployed, is it?
No, massively. That's something I'm so passionate about. Like, everywhere's 9 to 5,
yeah.
And it's so sad because what about the men who are working till 5 o'clock and also need support? You know, my husband works on a building site surrounded by men who need support, but by the time they finish work, there's nowhere they can go. So we're open Thursday evenings, 5 till 8, and we're also open Sunday evening, same time, 5 till 8. So people who work can also access them, and it's free to people who work as well.
I mean, you bring it up there with like the construction sector. I mean, it's so. I mean, it's rife in that. I mean, you read about it all the times in the paper. And I mean, I know as part of our Barbara Bettle Foundation, it's one area we're trying to look at around promoting suicide awareness and things like that. But I suppose it is a real tough environment to get into. And I suppose there needs to be more services like Sean's Place where people who do work or who work shifts and stuff can access. Because it's no good if it's 9 till 5 and you say, well, what am I going to do after take a day off work?
Yeah. And then you've got to tell your employer why you're taking a day off work.
Yeah.
And men just don't want to do that. But also what we found is over the festive period... We were open on the 27th of December in Connect Studios. We're open on Christmas Day as well. But we found so many mental health services shut for 2 weeks over Christmas.
Stupid.
And, you know, don't even have to look at the statistics. It's common knowledge. That's the most difficult time of year for so many people. So we will be open over the festive period. It might be an adapted timetable, but we'll be there for
probably
people.
Christmas Day must be the peak socially isolated day that if you're on your own, that's when you're going
to
be.
Yeah. Sean was quite lucky. Sean used to come to our house every Christmas and spend Christmas Day with us, but it's like, where would he go otherwise? We've got other family, don't get me wrong, he could have went to, but some people don't have that. And it's like, who's, you know, they might get a phone call to say Merry Christmas, but who would they share Christmas dinner with? Who's getting them a present Christmas morning? And they might have a family. I think the thing is, let's not put a stigma on it and think it's all men who live on their own who've got mental health issues. Some men have families who also have a mental health illness, and Christmas Day is just too overwhelming for them.
Yeah.
And they need to get out for an hour, have a break. Some men go to the pub, which is fine. Some men don't want to go to the pub. So it's just giving them options that they can go to, really.
I mean, you read about it all the time. And I mean, in our Bereaving by Suicide service, I mean, we've been involved in that for many years. And there's so many people who would be like, we just never, they were the last person, we never expected it, you know, wife, kids, or, you know, mum and dad, whatever, they never expected it. And you hear that so often.
I've seen it already with Sean's place. There's some lads who come in and they look like they've got everything, they've got successful jobs, you know, they've got careers, they're handsome, you know, they just look like they've got everything going for them.
Yeah.
And you look at them and think, God, if this has affected you, you know, who else? I'm just lucky that they've come to us, really. And
you can see broken bones, but not broken minds. Exactly. I read that the other day. I mean, it's a bit much that for me. Yeah, it's a bit too deep. Yeah, no, yeah, that's a bit much. That let's squash that. But no, it's totally, and you just don't know what's going on in someone's head. And I think one of the things you picked up on before, which is a frustration of mine within the third sector, definitely, is there's all these fantastic services about, but how are people meant to access them if the people who are meeting people at them crisis points or aren't referring in or don't know about it themselves? So I suppose, how are you at Sean's place going to ensure that people who are maybe in Sean's position now know about Sean's place and can access it?
Oh, by literally not sleeping. I'm literally every afternoon, I'm in a meeting. Like, obviously we're on social media, but I know not everybody accesses social media. I've been in the family wellbeing centres, the hospitals, the GPs, speaking to anyone who will listen.
Do you find they're supportive though? Do you find the people who are them gatekeepers, like the GPs, the mental health crisis teams, are these people being receptive to what you've got to offer?
From what I've found, yeah, and I feel quite sorry for them, because their responsibility is to find support for these people, but they haven't got the knowledge or the capacity to be able to signpost them to places that are suitable. I think that's the most important part, really, to make sure that they are suitable for them and that they will give them quality. The ones who are genuine won't just signpost them to anywhere and tick a box and say that they're gone. They'll make sure that it's right for them. I'm going to meet with the hospital next week, actually, to meet with their team there, who manage people like Sean in the community and want the best for their patients who they're looking after. So that's something really positive, the fact that they've contacted me actually today and said, please tell us more. We want to know where we can signpost people to.
I mean, all this stuff is very heavy salad stuff. You're dealing with people in crisis, a lot of emotionally draining stories, situations. How do you manage your own well-being? How do you, being the person who cares, care about yourself?
I think it's just being aware of it and reaching out to people when you need help.
Yeah.
I've got an amazing husband, amazing children. Like, I'm so lucky. I've got three fantastic children who keep anyone going, really.
Yeah.
I've got a lovely dog called Dave, you know. Okay. You can't Dave. Be sad when you got... Yeah, Dave the bulldog.
Dave the dog.
So, yeah, I've got people there when I need it. And also, you know, I have just lost my brother. It was 6 months ago. Not even 6 months ago, actually. And I've started counselling recently.
Yeah.
And I've always been one of them. Oh, you know, I'll be okay. Like, 1,000 people are... But I've actually found the benefit in going already, and I'm only two sessions in. So it is good to talk, and it's right to talk to the right people as well.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's not the closest person to you, surprisingly.
Yeah.
My poor husband hasn't got a clue what's going on inside my head half the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's easy to talk to strangers, and I think that's why somewhere like Sean's Place is important, because they might find it easy to talk to me, who don't know anything about them, than talk to their own family, which is when problems occur, then when they feel like they've got no one they can talk to.
Well, I suppose our area... Caring Connection, we're really passionate about is postvention. So that's supporting those individuals and families who've been bereaved by suicide and improving the support for them, because, you know, all the statistics show they're at great risk for recurring suicides, the well-being, all this type of thing. So I suppose, as someone who's gone through that, what would you say, not to name any names, that the support for people bereaved by suicide is like?
Personal experience wasn't great at all. Mm. It was actually quite shocking and worrying. The coroner referred us to a well-known organisation. When I called them, it took 6 weeks for them to get back to me to tell me that they couldn't help me because they were full to capacity and they had to be careful about who it was they had to be selective about who they help. So they sent me a book in the post, which I'd already read online anyway. Then there was another service that I was referred to as well for bereavement support, who had no one in the Northwest who could help me. So I was speaking to some guy down in London on the phone who kept apologising because he was like, I'm so sorry, there's no one in your area. We are recruiting in that area at the moment. And then it took
How does that help you, the recruiting?
You just felt a bit rubbish, really. They were saying sorry. It wasn't the guy's fault. He was apologising. But it took nearly 3 months for somebody from that organisation to then get in touch who was from this area. They came out to see me. Oh, no, they apologised because something important had come up on my appointment, so they had to cancel. So when they did come out to see me a week later, it was an hour appointment, pour my heart out to them. They said, OK, so we'll give you a call in about a month's time. And it just wasn't good enough. You know, I'm quite a strong willed person, I'd like to think, and I find it okay to cope most of the time. But like my mum, for example, or somebody who's just lost a son, or lost a husband or the partner, it's a dangerous game, really, and we need better support.
So what, in that situation with other people, they could have just fell through the gap and they're another statistic in that family.
Massively.
Another life gone.
Yeah, I could easily see how that could happen from my own experience. I think the massive gap as well is with every suicide, there's an inquest.
Yeah.
And there just isn't enough support there for people with the inquest procedures. You will literally get tied up in knots unless you've got support in place, someone to guide you through them procedures.
So if people aren't familiar with it, if someone has died by suicide or an unexplained death, it will usually go to an inquest, which will be the legal proceedings. Be like it's like it goes to a court, doesn't it?
Yeah,
you
actually go to a court. That's something I'm going to be looking to work with people for in the future to help people understand inquest procedures. I'm quite lucky. I've got an amazing barrister who's offered to help us. Without her, I don't know where I'd be, because you would literally, the jargon that they use, the lingo that they use, and people aren't getting the answers to the questions that they need answering because they don't know the right words to say or they don't know the right form to fill out.
So and the purpose of the inquest, Debbie, that's to try and understand what has actually led to this situation. So if they were in a hospital or whatever, has there been failings where they could have been learning in the future? It's not like a criminal thing, is it?
It's not a cause of blame, they say, but sometimes there is questions that need answering.
Yeah.
So it's what, where, how and why, basically, that they will answer. But it's your opportunity to ask your questions and to have things looked into. And there's a lot of families who are desperate to get these answers, especially where things have gone wrong and there has been, they call it missed opportunities, which is not great to hear, but that's exactly what they are. And things will never improve in services unless these missed opportunities are identified.
What would you say, you're listening to this now and you're someone who's been bereaved by suicide and, you know, you've got an inquest coming up or you don't even know what an inquest is. What is there anything you could recommend to them or anything that helped you or anything you'd advise them to look at?
I think for me, I was so determined. I fired in my belly to make sure that I got this right for Sean. It was the last thing I could do for him, really. We've still not actually had Sean's inquest. That's still to come. But the proceedings leading up to it, I just had to do my homework. There was no one I could physically speak to in the early days. It was literally just going online, reading books. The organisation Inquest, they do have a lot of resources online that you can look at yourself.
And that's an organisation called Inquest?
Yeah, they're actually called Inquest. And most of what they tell you on the phone, to be honest, is already online. So if you do have the time to look through that, that will help you understand some of it. But as I say, I would have missed out on so much had I not had this barrister. So I think there does need to be more resources that put these really difficult legal terms into layman's terms so that the average person can understand them.
Yeah. Well, as I say, I mean, at Caring Connections, we run the Barbara Bettle Foundation. We set that up to support people bereaved by suicide, but very specifically in counselling and cognitive behavioural therapy, and that came from me being bereaved by suicide. A close family member, which was Barbara, took her own life, and the support was just shite. It just wasn't there, and the after effects, and you're just on your own. You had this help as a handbook, and you had to wade your way through it. and everything about it's brutal. I mean, even with the suicide, having the police involved and just the whole process. And I think the thing with suicide as well is that with some of them, there's often like media, you've got things like that. You've got the taboo of suicide as well. You've got certain things with, I don't know if it's still iffy within the church and getting buried with something. You know, there's so much issues that still surround suicide that I think unless you've been through it, you wouldn't realise. That's why I think it makes such a complex death and a complex grief.
I think that's a problem as well, because the organisations and, you know, the coroner's office and everything like that, they talk to you in this jargon like you've been through it before.
Yeah.
It's a unique situation to go through, and you only go through it when you go through it, if that makes sense. And even associating the word coroner and inquest with your family member, that was heartbreaking for me.
Yeah.
I didn't even know there would be an inquest, and then the words was just threw at me like it was nothing. And to have that, you know, I'd only ever heard them words on Emmerdale. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's not something you hear every day.
Yeah.
And to have them words associated with my brother, it was just shocking and awful, and people need to be better prepared.
Because when it becomes real, because I think, especially with myself, it's like, so nah, that had never happened in our family, you know, that had never happened. And then when it happens, you're thinking, shit, could that happen to someone else? And then, I don't know, it gives you that anxiety and things like that. So that's why I look at things like, you know, we do applied suicide intervention training and all that, but I do have sometimes a little bit of scepticism about with training and certain things, because if people are too aware, then you get too anxious, and there's certain situations, like even in my family, you couldn't have done nothing really about it. You couldn't, it's not like there was a failing from the family side, there's nothing you could do. But where I do see there's massive failings, and I think it's very similar to Sean, is that social isolation seems to be the key issue, which I've seen as a massive precursor to suicide. As soon as they stop integrating, not getting involved in social activities, they can go to the doctors all they want and get the medication, but if there isn't that support to re-engage and get back into society like Sean's place is doing, then that to me is the biggest thing, the clinical and the community model coming together.
Yeah, I think the only thing that Sean was offered around the time from the people who were caring for him was the gym. And exercise is fantastic. Yeah. But if you suffer from anxiety, walking into your average gym is just not going to happen. It's too much of a big deal. So I think more awareness needs to be around. And, you know, Sean's place isn't the only place in Liverpool that people can access who does this kind of service. So it's coming together, really. I think collaboration for me is the biggest thing that is going to tackle this awful issue. It's about bringing people together who all offer something different and providing this holistic approach. If I don't provide something to Sean's place, I've got no qualms about signposting them to somewhere down the road, because I don't own that person. We might, you know, you're applying for funding and things like
that. For this to work, everyone has to have that mindset.
It really does. And I'm finding it already a bit of a challenge to make people remember why they're in this game, really. We're in it because of the people that are coming to us. We're not in it for the funding or, you know, for the form filling. We're in it to find the best service for these people that are walking through our door.
Yeah.
And I think if people remember that, we'll be okay.
Yeah, totally. Again, from being around this sector, it's something that is a massive issue, and you've got duplication of services, you've got people holding on to individuals, and it is a massive problem. But as I say, like you were saying, there's some fantastic organisations out there. Just to name a few, we've got ones like the Open Door Centre, the Spider Project. You've got like Papyrus, Jake Mills, and the work he's doing at Chasing the Stigma. There's loads of them, but I'm in this game and I still don't know them all, and some of them still can be quite hard to find. So if you're struggling and you're already feeling a bit rough, how are you going to find them? You need this holistic approach, but it until that's done, I don't think we're going to get anywhere with it. So if people are unfamiliar with social prescribing, like my basic understanding of how it works is, like, you may go to doctors for, you know, a mental health condition, and you may be prescribed with X, Y, and Z antidepressants, but it may be that the issue that you're having, mental health or anxiety, is that you're in debt or you've got relationship problems. So by working with the social prescriber, they would then interlink you with services around deaths, relationship advice, community integration, so that they would provide that community support and hopefully, if it was working effectively, be that gatekeeper to refer into places like Sean's place.
I really do hope it's a positive thing. I did smile when I heard about that it was coming out. It was shortly after Sean had passed away that it became a new initiative. But there definitely needs to be something more than going to the doctors and be given medication, because some people don't actually need medication in that first instance.
Yeah.
They need, as you say, social integration. They need well-being support. And it may never lead to medication. Mm. So, yeah, I hope that it is a positive thing. The only thing as well that I will say with that is that these services that are being prescribed to, if you like, so Sean's place will become one of them places. We've got loads of places in Sefton. Who's supporting them services to manage these people? Because you can signpost 100 people to Sean's place, but if we're not getting supported financially from the government, from the NHS, we'll go under, and then Sean's place isn't there anymore to support the men. Mm-hmm. So, or, you know, anybody that's accessing any service. So I do think, you know, there's a lot of work to be done there, but hopefully it's a good thing.
It's a very, but I suppose when you look at things around finances, I mean, I was reading something today and it was saying like each suicide, when they cost it up, it costs like 1.5 million when you cost like the treatment, days from work, the impact on family. There was all other like elements that went into it, but they costed it out at about 1.5 million. So you think, if they just invested into services like Sean's Place, which even if it saved one life, you know, the economics there. But like we were saying before, I think we're at a point of crisis with most of our service now, and prevention is kind of going out the window. And one of the things that I hear regularly is that how do you actually measure prevention, especially in something like suicide, where suicide is a thing, is quite a rare occurrence. Do you base it on suicide attempts? Do you base it on suicidal idea? How do you measure if an intervention has been successful in suicide?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I don't know is the answer with that one. I think, for me, I'm going to be working with organisations to encourage them to signpost their employees to us for our evening sessions, for example, because sickness absence due to workplace stress is ridiculously high in so many workplaces at the moment. Yeah. And employees don't know what to do about it. They're not trained to manage stress and mental health. You know, they're there to produce figures and finances and everything else. So we will be working with employees to try and reduce their sickness absence, if you like, and you know that will give you outcomes and, you know, show you if the services are doing what they're supposed to be doing. I'd like to say that the number of suicides will fall, but you just don't know.
And you can't, and it's one of them, you can't say it. And I think I was reading another article and it was about, are performance measures within this sort of game useful, and really what are they used for? So, I mean, are you just, you know, reporting on these things because a funder asks for it, or the commissioner says, right, you've got to have this, saw this many people? When really with things like suicide, you know, you're not going to know the outcome, but if you've provided that service and that's of good quality and you've got the feedback from the person saying, you know what, this has helped me, isn't that enough?
I think for me, that would be the biggest thing. We done our first pilot and we had this one lad come to us, and he was, and he won't mind me saying this, he was a nervous wreck when he come in. He didn't want to speak to anyone. He just wanted to be left alone because he'd walked through the door and that was enough for him at that moment in time. By the time he left, he was buzzing. He'd had a lovely time. He tried every session we had available to him. He'd made connections. Mm. He's actually had a laugh, and he's come back to us every single time. And for me, that's more important. I don't even like statistics, because these people aren't statistics. They're human beings with families and feelings and a life. But I think for me, seeing the reaction on this guy from the time he walked into the time he left, that's my evaluation. And I might not be able to capture that in black and white on pieces of paper, but I'll know that what I'm doing is right.
And that's it. And I think that's what these commissioning bodies and funding bodies have to understand. I think it's got to a point where things have been overly financially driven, where it has just been, what's the outcome, what's the outcome, what's this, what's that? And I think probably a lot of money has been wasted on certain things. But like as you say, I mean, we see it with ourselves, that case study evidence of someone who's come through the door at day one of maybe the council intervention, then at session 8, they just look like a totally different person. Mm. And it's that, how do you capture that? You might get a form, say, ah, this is great, this, and a scale that says they've improved 35%. But there's certain, I suppose, them soft outcomes, which you just can't measure.
And it's on what day are we measuring them? You know, so mental health comes in waves. You'll have a good day, and then you'll have 10 awful days, and then you might have 20 good days. So you could do that evaluation on one of their really bad days. And, you know, for them, they love the intervention that you provide and they love the services. You're not curing these people, you're supporting them. And I think that's the difference.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I think if there's anything that, you know, we take away from the service we've done with the Barbara Bettel Foundation, is that, you know, it's such a personalised thing, mental health. Everyone's treatment support, even if they go to counselling, it's totally different. The type of counselling they're required, the way the CBT is managed, the support plan, it's such a personalised thing. And I suppose that is the difficulty in mental health treatment. There isn't a prognosis as you would if you had like a physical ailment. It's quite hard to say, right, well, if we let that person out of an inpatient facility, they're going to lose their life in X amount of days if we haven't done X intervention. Whereas if they had, you know, whatever physical ailments, if we don't, we can do this surgery and it's gone. And I think that is one of the big challenges with it. But I think, like you were saying before, people all need to be working on the same page and in the same mindset, is that it is better together.
Yeah, it's massively, and I'm going to an event tomorrow night where there's going to be so many different organisations there, all there for the same reason, is to improve mental health services across Liverpool.
What's that?
It's Mallet in the Community again, who are producing it. These guys are like up and coming, they're amazing.
Yes, they haven't invited us.
I'm speaking at it tomorrow night. Yeah. I'll give you the mention. But yeah, so that, again, you know, there's so many organisations there, all for the same reason, and I'm really hoping that, you know, I'm going to wear my Sean's Police T-shirt. People will come over and talk to us, and you know, signpost people to us. We can signpost people to them and do events together. It's just going to be key, and we've got so many groups that aren't amazing and are willing to do that. We just need to bring the rest in line with us now and make sure that they're willing to share as well.
So as we're getting close to the end of the first podcast, what do you think Liverpool as a region cares?
Yeah, do you know, I was so, what's the word, overwhelmed when Sean passed away, and it was only an idea. I didn't even think I'd be capable of doing this. And the minute I started speaking to people and telling them what I was thinking about doing, the organisations that wanted to get involved, the people that were getting involved, the support, it's amazing. Like Liverpool, Sefton, Knowsley, it's a massively caring place. It's just knowing, and this is the key, and it's knowing where to find them. Unfortunately, some people like myself don't find them till it's too late. But hopefully, if there's enough awareness out there, we can work together, we can help other people find them in time.
If you were to name three people who you'd say, who cares in the region, some people who you'd say, right, they'd be great on this podcast, who would they be? Just off the top of your head. It doesn't matter.
I don't want to upset anyone who was out mentioning them.
No, just on the top. I'm just saying three people who you think, and it doesn't have to be, because one of the things with this podcast, it's not going to just be people from like services as ours. It might be people, you know, sports people or people from, you know, who are in business, or just people who do something a bit different but have shown they care about the city and about the people of the city and the community. So go ahead then, give us three.
Oh my goodness. I'm so sorry if I don't mention anybody. I'll try my best.
No, she's not. She had this prepared. She's shaking her head.
Firstly, I've got to mention Kelly Phillips and Michael Skelly from Connect Studios. Okay. They have given us their venue for free. They give a lot of support to the community. They're only two young people who have opened this community group.
And that's in Seaforth.
It's in Seaforth. It's where we host Sean's Place. They're just so kind with everything that they do, and they're all about giving back to the community. Without them, Sean's Place wouldn't have even been happening.
Okay.
So that's number one. Number two, I will say, I've got to mention Mallet in the Community. To be honest, I've met the girl once, but I just love what they do because they're doing it different.
Right, what's the person called?
Anna. Oh, got it right.
Anna.
Anna, her name is. Do you know what? I'm sure she does it with another lady, but I've not met the other lady.
All right, so Anna and the other lady from Mallet in the Community, but we're saying Anna.
They they're just doing things differently. They're finding new innovative ways to.
So do you reckon they'd be good to get on here?
Yeah, fantastic. Okay. I think they'd be really good. And then
number two.
Do you know, I'm torn between two people. Can I mention two? Can you have mentioned two more? Oh, I'd mention ten more, but I'm going to tell. There's two more. One of them is a new lady that I've met. She's from an organisation called New Beginnings Improving Lives, and her name's Michelle. And she goes around every single community group that
What's
I can
the
think
second
of.
Name?
Oh, I don't know.
How am I going to get them on? I can't just put Michelle in Google.
I'll message her. She's been going around loads of different organisations and just trying to bring them together for the purpose of improving mental health. And she's just a one-woman band who's literally just trying her best to bring organisations together, which I love.
And this is the ridiculous thing. These people, we've been in this game for like 10 years. We've been around for donkeys. I haven't heard of these organisations, and why haven't I?
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
It. And I feel dead lucky that I've met these people and they've given the time to us. There's a million people I can mention. I'm so sorry if I don't mention you. I've got to mention this one guy called Kev Deves. He's the mindfulness coach that we're using at the moment.
Kev Deves.
He's a mindfulness coach, but he's given so much time to Sean's place. He's been at every single pilot day, as have several other people, like our hypnotherapist and the art therapist. They're just absolutely amazing people who have given
the best
time.
Only joking, everyone.
They're all amazing.
He's the best.
But I'm mentioning Kev because I think he'd be good for your podcast. He's such a deep and spiritual person, and he's actually given me some advice. Like, obviously, sent a lot to Sean. He keeps trying to get me to, like,
he's not going to be there doing
up.
All like heavy breathing down the mic, is it? Because that might sound a bit iffy.
No,
that.
But he's just deep, and he just makes you think of things in a different way. And I'm dead lucky to have him on board at the Sean's Place team. I think he'd be an interesting one for your podcast.
And does he go round different organisations doing this type of stuff?
So he's got his own business as well, but he wants to support people with mental illness.
Okay, brilliant.
He does a lot of work with different organisations and stuff, but as I say, he's been a massive support to me with opening Sean's Place.
So when we put some stuff on, you know, to go with the podcast, can we maybe get the details of some of these, like the websites or whatever, these
people,
so we can put them up?
Yeah, they're all on social media. So
okay, fantastic. So if there was a final thought from you, Debbie, if you want to give one final maybe plug about Sean's Place or a thought or whatever, what do you want it to be?
The final thought for me would just be that it's to beg organisations who are working in the mental health area to come together and collaborate more, share services, share the support, signpost people to these different services. It's so vital that we remember why we're doing this and
who we're doing it for. I'm a mental health service and I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, you know what, I want to work with Debbie, I want to work with Sean's Police, what's the best way to contact you?
At the moment, it'd be through social media.
So through your Facebook?
Yeah, through Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn.
Okay, so just direct message, yeah?
Yeah, just direct messages and, you know, I'll come and meet you for a cup of coffee. We'd love our cup of coffees. I love face-to-face chat. You don't get to know a person over social media. You get to know them by meeting up with them and having a cup of tea.
Okay, brilliant. And finally, if I'm... well, hopefully there's some, you know, young fellas or... well, not young fellas, any fellas listening to this podcast who... and in need of support and they think, I don't know about Sean's Place. Why would they come? Why should they come to Sean's Place?
Do you know what? It sounds ridiculous and this might sound a bit patronising. I'm so sorry if it does. I don't mean it to. When my kids won't eat the tea, I say to them, do you know what, kids? Trying something new is good for you.
Yeah,
they laugh every time, but they'll try it. And, you know, people need to try that with different services. Women need to do it as well. Women are more open to trying new things. Men are terrified that it might not work out. But because it's called mindfulness, it doesn't mean you're lying on the floor with your legs in the hair like a Buddha.
Yeah.
It means that, you know, you're getting support for your well-being and for your mental health. Give it a go. Come and try in our class. We've got so many people who are coming saying, oh, I can't do ours, I'm really rubbish. And by the end of it, they're amazing. Like, they're so good.
Yeah.
It's just about having that conversation, doing something positive with your day and with your time and remembering who you are and what your aspirations are and, you know, making the future look a little bit brighter, really.
Okay, so if I want to come to one of your things, again, I will just go on to social media, which is...
at Sean's Place 2.
At Sean's Place 2, and that's on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram.
Yeah.
And I will go on there and that'll tell me all about what's on offer, how I get to access them and where about you're located.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Debbie. Very inspiring individual who cares about the city.
Thanks
a lot, Debbie. So that brings us to the end of our very first podcast. Thank you all for listening. I hope you listen to the next one, which we're going to be doing in February. Our next guest is not confirmed, but we're going to try and get someone from a bit of a sporting background, or maybe even someone from Mallet in the community. Like the sound of that, we can do a bit of a drama piece on here, but maybe.
Yeah, do it. Trying something new is good for you.
Let's edit that out. Nah, only messing. So yeah, so thank you, Debbie, very much. Someone who truly cares. And Sean's Place is an inspirational service that you should seek out if you are in need of support and you are a man. So thanks everyone for listening. And that brings me to the end of episode 1 of the Who Cares podcast.